commencing countdown. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, guys. Episode number one.
The place where dreams explode into confetti.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Adam.
And today we're going to talk a little bit about the nebulas, which just happened on Saturday evening. We had the pleasure of actually watching it live from, was it Ustream.tv or something?
Yeah, it was cool because, you know, you actually had some of the authors and event organizers chatting with you.
Yeah, like Mary Robinette Cowell.
That was really cool.
Yeah, she was there, and I think she was kind of in charge of the video thing, and that was really cool that they set that up for us. I was really happy about that.
Yeah, I hope they do it next year, too.
They probably will. I'm thinking this is going to be an annual thing from now on, just because it's, you know, before, you know, 10 years ago, they wouldn't have even had anything like this, and now, you know, if you can't make it to the nebulas, you can at least see the ceremonies, and that kind of, I think, is really good for the science fiction fantasy community. It kind of brings us all together a little bit more.
My favorite part was Joe Haldeman's acceptance speech for the Grandmaster. He is an awesome guy.
Yeah, I want to say he lives in Gainesville, where I live, but I maybe get the wrong author, but I think he lives here.
And you haven't met him. Why?
Because I just found out that he lives here, and apparently I was talking to one of my professors about this, and he mentioned it. I didn't know, and I was shocked. And apparently the creative writing program here has never brought him out because they're one of those anti-sci-fi people's kind of programs, and so they have never brought him out, even though he's kind of a fairly big author, at least in science fiction. He's fairly enormous in science fiction.
Yeah.
And they never brought him out. And in fact, the creative writing program out here, he's bringing out all these guys who write literary fiction that I don't even think they have books out. I don't even know who the hell these people are. So, but anyway, that really doesn't have anything to do with this. So we're going to go right through the nebulas, since you have a lot more opinion on these than I do, Adam. So why don't we start with the short story? The winner of the short story. Well, the first off, the nominees were Hooves in the Hovel of Abdel Jamila by Saladin Ahmed. And I'm sorry if I'm butchering names. That was from Clockwork Phoenix number 2. I Remember the Future by Michael A. Burstein. Which was in Apex, and then Non-Zero Probabilities by N.K. Jemisin, Spar by Kij Johnson, Going Deep by James Patrick Kelly, and Bridesicle by Will McIntosh. And the winner of that one was Spar by Kij Johnson. And Adam, you have a very different opinion on this. You thought that I Remember the Future should have won. Care to explain your reasonings for why you didn't like Spar?
Yeah, well, you know, Spar, if you haven't read it, is basically a 2,000-word sex scene, and it's a very vulgar, descriptive. It kind of makes you ill after you read it, and, I've read it a bunch of times because I'm just, you know, I knew as soon as I read it was going to win after the Nebula nominees were announced. I mean, it shouldn't have come as a shock to me, but I still was hoping for I Remember the Future or Bridesicle, because both of those stories are, you know, very good stories. I don't like it because if you take away the vulgar language, it would not have, I don't know, even been published. I mean, it was published because it took that chance with language, and I don't think it's it didn't sit well with me. It didn't seem like a story worthy of a nebula because the substance of it wasn't, I didn't think, was of the quality that past nebula winners were.
Yeah, I haven't read it. In fact, I haven't read most everybody that was nominated, sadly. that's interesting that you think that it due to its controversial nature, its language, that it sort of picked up the win as a result.
I'm not trying to make enemies, but I honestly do think that because of how controversial it was, it picked up the win because, you know, Bride's Occult was a better story. It had more plot, more character. And, you know, I Remember the Future is just really, really cool. I have to read that again. It's been a while since I've read it. But Spar, I didn't think had anything going for it. I mean, honestly, nothing happens besides this woman having sex with the alien and commenting on it and thinking about it. And yes, it is I think Kids Johnson was trying to create this just ultimate, you know, sense of alienation and isolation, and she succeeds there, but it's not much of a story. It's more of a commentary.
Well, I'll have to read it, and maybe I'll have some opinions on it for the second episode, but it's actually very interesting. You have a couple where you disagreed with them, not so much with the novelette category, but...
No, that's because novelette actually got it right, and I was really surprised. Sinner, Baker, Fabulous Priest, Red Mask, Black Mask, Gentleman, Beast by U.G. Foster was the best story of 2009, in my opinion. I mean, it was unique. It had a very interesting narrative style, and it was a series of vignettes, but they were all connected beautifully. Characterization was very strange, but it worked because in the story, when you put on a different mask, you're basically a different person. But she kept a consistent characterization going, but superficially it was different, but under how the characters acted was different, but it was, you know, same character, and you could tell that the character was, you know, the same character.
Yeah,
and it was just really cool.
Yeah, and it beat out some pretty big names in science fiction and fantasy right now, like Paolo Bacigalupi. How do you say his last name?
I think it's Bacigalupi.
Bacigalupi? Okay.
Something like that.
I can pronounce that. Bacigalupi. Yeah. They had a whole deal where they laughed because one of the presenters couldn't pronounce his name. And, yep. The whole crowd was like, Bacigalupi, or however they said it. But
yep, The Gambler, great story. I really like that one. Bishop's Vinegar Peace or The Wrong Way Used Orphanage, Adult Orphanage, also a really cool story. And then the other ones, they're not, you know, they're good. They're just not as good as those three. So, yeah, that category was the one that took away the sting of Spar winning.
All right. Well, now that we have the novella, which the winner actually went to Cage Baker's story, Moment of Silence for Her Passing, if we may.
Mm-hmm. And that one, I read Arkfall by Carolyn Ives Gilman, and that had a really cool idea with basically if you started a colony underneath Io, you know, there's a big ocean under the ice. And it was the repercussions of that. And, you know, a really cool idea. I didn't think it was executed very well. Mm-hmm. And then I know of the other ones. I've read Sublimation Angels by Sanford, which is, you know, brilliant.
Yeah, it was really good.
Shambling Towards Hiroshima, I've been meaning to read because Morrow kind of has that cult following.
Yeah, I've read that one. That one's actually really, really interesting. I don't think that one could have won. I had been rooting for Sublimation Angels, but I'm also very happy for Baker that she got The Women of Nell Gwynn's, I haven't read The God Engines by Scalzi.
I hear it's good.
Yeah, I've heard it's good. I haven't read it. I follow Scalzi's blog, and so I've heard a lot about it. I need to read some of his other work first. I mean, I've read, oh, good Lord, what's the name of it? Old Man's War.
Awesome book. Love that.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. I had my brother, I think, read that one, and he really liked that, too.
That got me back into reading contemporary science fiction, because for a while I just thought there was no one doing it right anymore, and Scalzi did it right with that book.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a very original novel. I mean, he even admits this. He takes stuff from all over the place. Mm-hmm. But it's just the way he wrote it. He took all these kind of used ideas that have been used before, but he did it in such a way that, like, it was just really interesting. The character was a lot of fun to sort of read about.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. So we're going to skip over the novel category, because that is one that I think you have particular contentions with. We're going to go straight to the Ray Bradbury Award for Outstanding Dramatic Presentation, which is fancy language for Best Science Fiction or Fantasy Film. And there were a lot of big titles on this. I think anybody listening right now would know, you know, there was Star Trek, District 9, Avatar, Moon, Up, Coraline. Really some big titles, all of these, with the exception maybe of Coraline. It was kind of a smaller title. But still in terms of what was on the list. And I was praying to the heavens that they would not give it to Star Trek or Avatar, because I despise J.J. Abrams with a passion, and Avatar just doesn't deserve to win just because it was pretty. And I haven't seen Moon, so I can't say whether I thought Moon would have deserved it, but I've been rooting for District 9, and that's the one that won. Neil Blomkamp and Terry Tatchell for District 9, and they won. And absolutely deserved it, because I think of the sci-fi films of last year, District 9 was just amazing. I just finished an essay on that, by the way, tonight, and submitted it, so...
Whew. Yep, District, out of those, although if Up would have won, I actually wouldn't have minded that, too, because that was also a very good movie, which is weird, because, you know, you say Pixar, you think kids' movies, but they are ramping it up lately. But
yeah.
District 9... really, as I mean, it had that classic, you know, science fiction allegorical awesomeness combined with new age killer graphics and special effects. It was everything a science fiction movie should be.
Yeah, I agree, and I did like Up, but I didn't think in comparison to the majority of Pixar stuff, I didn't think Up was one of their best.
I do.
Oof, I would put it maybe fourth or fifth down, personally. I put some of their other films higher up on the list, but that's me, and I'm but I'm also I'm a huge fan of Monsters, Inc. So.
Oh, I love Monsters, Inc. That's a great movie.
I watched that. I had when I worked at a Kmart back in the glory days when we still had Kmarts. We'd play movies on the TVs, you know, because I worked electronics, and I would have that movie and just have the title screen play, because it has that cool jazzy song. I would just have that play for like hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just dance around in the electronics department because I just love that song. So it's all like that fun Disney kind of, you know, I think Pixar's like really where Disney, all of like the Disney juice went. So because they kind of, I don't know, I think Disney animation has really sort of fallen. Like, Disney sort of split. It's like all of the animated stuff is gone to Pixar, and then they've diverted so much attention to like live action adult films, which I think for the most part the stuff that Disney has done have been pretty good. So,
aren't Disney behind the Prince of Persia movie?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's either them or it's Last Airbender, but I doubt that because that's Nickelodeon. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nickelodeon has their own branch for movies.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So then. Yeah, well, we can talk about that another episode. Maybe we can both go see it, and then we can have a rant about why Shyamalama Ding Dong was the worst director, or maybe whether he redeemed himself.
I think he'll redeem himself.
I hope so. I think this is the movie that could do it. But that's for another episode. And then to continue to avoid novel category, going to the Andre Norton Award for Young Adult Science Fiction and Fantasy. The winner to that actually went to the one with the coolest freaking title I've ever seen for a novel, which is The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making by Catherine M. Valente. And it was really up against some big stuff, like another Scalzi book, a Scott Westerfeld book, a Cage Baker book, and some other smaller authors. So.
I really thought that Leviathan was gonna take it, just with all the buzz around it when it came out. I mean, it was everywhere. But I'm glad. I actually glad to see this, because this one wasn't even published. It was put up on her own site, wasn't it? Wasn't it serialized on CatherineMValente.com or wherever her website is?
Yeah, it does seem so. I'm looking at the link right now, and it does seem that way. So.
And that one, and that is so cool. I mean, that honestly is like. CIFWA accepting where, you know, short fiction and even long fiction, because this is a novel, is going.
Yeah, it does look like it's all available online for free. I don't know how I feel about that.
But then again, for your short stories, you had two Clark's World stories, and then I Remember the Future was originally not, but Apex put it up for free for a while.
Well, see, but that for me is different, because there's a difference, because those people still get paid for the stories that are put up for free by the by like Clark's World. I don't know if she was paid to do that. I think she just put that up.
No, she didn't. She wasn't paid to do it. She just did it because she wanted to. Just interesting.
Well, we can have another discussion about that.
Yeah, that's kind of like why you hate self-publishing, yet it worked for her.
Yeah, but she was also established before she did this. So
yeah, if
that's
you're
a
established,
little bit
you can do anything.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, other authors have done this, and it works. You can do it. But the difference, I think, though, is this is sort of like a lighter version of self-publishing, because like, she didn't go around like trying to sell books and stuff like that. It was just up for free. I think in that sense, I kind of feel better about it, but I don't know how I feel about them selecting that one. But we can talk about that sort of subject for another time. Now we're going to go to the, I think, one of your most controversial things. So the novel category, which was kind of one of the big ones, had quite a lot of big stuff on the ballot. It had The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacci Galuppi, The Love We Share Without Knowing by Barzac. I think that's one of the ones I've read by Barzac, and Barzac's really good. Flesh and Fire by Laura Ann Gilman, The City in the City by Mieville, Boneshaker by Sherry Priest, and Finch by Jeff Vandermeer. And the winner to that went to The Wind-Up Girl, and Adam, you said it should have gone to The City in the City, which, honestly, I was kind of surprised it didn't, just because of the sort of hype for that book, and sort of Mieville, the fact that he just won, was it the Clark?
Yep, third award Clark Award.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, it was kind of a shock that The Wind-Up Girl won, not because I've read any of these particular novels, but with the exception of the Barzac. But you completely disagreed with that.
Well, it's not that The Wind-Up Girl isn't a terrible book. Like, I think Spire just isn't a very good short story. The Wind-Up Girl is a fine book, and it's a good example of, you know, what people are starting to call the green punk movement. Mm-hmm. But I think The Wind-Up Girl won because it was an example of the green punk movement. Just because, you know, like, climate change and all is a hot-button issue, and science fiction, you know, it traditionally looks at these hot-button issues at the moment in time. You know, we're, like, supposed to be the lens on that. But but I just thought that The City and the City was such a better book than The Wind-Up Girl. I mean, based on the originality, the prose. I mean, China Mieville is probably the best writer we have in science fiction and fantasy right now. That guy can flat out spin a yarn.
Yeah, his prose style is really good, yeah.
And so just creative. And you know, if not The City, I would have given it to Finch by Jeff Vandermeer, just because of how much fun that book was, and because Vandermeer also is an amazing writer. And his was also really unique, which is weird because he had two like noirish detective stories on the novel ballad.
Yeah, and Underland Press, which published Finch, is actually a fairly small press that just started up, was it last year or the end of 08?
I remember them starting up. I don't know when exactly.
It was somewhere around there, yeah.
But yeah, Finch should have won some kind of special award for the best cover of last year, because that cover is amazing, amazing.
Yeah, it's a fairly memorable cover. They don't have a cover category, so they wouldn't have given that. But
There is a special award for best book cover that Finch won.
Is it an award separate from the Nebulas, or is it just...
Yeah, okay. It's an award separate from the Nebula, but still won it. And it's weird, because I think Subterranean put out a special edition of The City in the City, and it kind of looked like the Finch cover with the gun and like, you know, and the person all kind of superimposed over each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, huh, that's different. How they were so similar.
That's interesting, yeah.
If that makes sense.
Subterranean Press does that a lot, though. They republish all sorts of books. I mean, didn't they publish a book version of Metatropolis?
Mm-hmm.
And then now Tor is doing that, too.
I listened to Metatropolis. I didn't think it was all that good.
I haven't read it yet. I have a couple of it on audio. I'm a Tobias Bekel nut, so...
I mean, Scalzi's story was good, but because, you know, Scalzi can write.
Mm-hmm.
But The other ones were kind of a bit highfalutin for me.
Yeah, well...
Who says that anymore?
You're from, like, the crazy Midwest or North Midwest or whatever you call it.
People don't say highfalutin over here. Trust me.
Well, then you were born in Utah. I don't know.
I was born in Madison.
Wisconsin. Which is where the Madison Scouts are. Yes. You don't even know what that is.
No, I don't.
The marching band.
Ah.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to get away from my marching band days from high school. So, I mean, other than that, I mean, the wars are really interesting to watch. It's really nice to see it happening live. They did an interesting presentation about this, like, Mars simulation where they put a bunch of people in, like, this building and they had to live basically how they would have to live on Mars, with the exception that they could breathe air outside.
Well, it was interesting, but it was so long.
Yeah, I went and cooked dinner during some of it, but they tell me that it's online, and I think I will watch it, and I think seeing how they had to sort of learn how to do that stuff, I think that'll be really useful for writers, but it was kind of dry for the awards, but...
I'm pumped to see how this this Russian, European, Chinese, or whatever joint venture for the 500-plus day actual full-size Mars experiment. That's going to be interesting to see how that happens.
Yeah, that'll be pretty intense. Goodness. Well, we'll see. Whew. I can just imagine, like, after a couple days of not showering very well, that would just not go.
I mean, honestly, that is the closest thing we have ever come to the J.G. Ballard story, 13 for Centaurus, where the scientists don't even tell the people that they're in the experiment. They actually think they're going to Alpha Centauri to start a new Earth colony, and they're in here for like 50 years.
That's interesting. I haven't read that one. I bet you it's in my collected stories that I bought, which is like...
Well, probably, because it's all of the short ones.
Well, yeah, it's probably in there. That book is like 50 pounds, so...
I want to buy that book so bad. I only have the best of, and that, you know, the Atrocity Exhibition, oh my goodness, that's a short story for the ages.
I haven't read that one either. I mean, so poorly read. Every time you mention all these people you've read, I feel like an idiot.
I know, considering, you know, I'm like, what, 6-7 years younger?
Yeah, so. Yeah, don't I'm recommend just, too much.
Well, it's just I read a ton of short stories compared to novels.
Oh, okay, well, that makes sense.
I mean, I have probably close to 70 anthologies.
That's
I mean, right now, within reach of me is Dangerous Visions, and again, Dangerous Visions, one of the mammoth books of best new horror, Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang, the best of J.G. Ballard by J.G. Ballard. What else do we have here?
A lot of stuff. Your book,
Chaucer, if that counts.
No, Chaucer does not count.
It's an anthology.
It doesn't count.
It counts. It counts.
Nope.
It's an anthology.
Nope,
it's made
it's
up. I know, but you know, Chaucer was he was a good writer.
No, he wasn't. He was terrible. He didn't write in English.
Middle English.
It's not real English. That's like a whole different language. It's where the word Knigget came from.
I don't even know what that means.
I think it means knight, like K-N-I-G-H-T, knight.
Oh, it's Knigt. Knigt.
Whatever, Knigget. They say Knigget in Monty Python, so I'm going with Knigget.
I know. That's because you pronounce every single consonant in Middle English.
Ugh.
I mean, there are some like exceptions, like T-H is still th. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
But,
don't
but
keep
it's,
doing it.
But it's, yeah, it's Knigt, because a G sounds like a...
Oh, okay, so it's kind of like German. Yeah, it's got German influences. Anyway,
it sounds a lot like German.
We're going way off of topic here. So, since this is actually a re-recording of our intro, because the other one was really dull, and really, I mean, the Nebulas, we should have had this in our first episode anyway, since we were releasing it basically at the same time.
Yeah.
Just a few things we should mention. At the end of the episode, we mentioned ways to contact us and said we didn't have voicemail. We actually have voicemail now, so if you want to call us, the number is 206-337-8255. 8423. I don't know how it works. It's probably an automated message. I've never done this before, but hey, whatever. It's also on our website, which is skiffyandfanty.wordpress.com, in case you forget or whatever, delete this before writing down the number or whatever. But do please call us, leave a message, hate mail. We enjoy hate mail. In fact, if you come up with a really good hate mail, maybe we'll play it. And
please, if you have a reason why Sparse should have won, because people have told me I'm wrong, but no one's told me why I'm wrong. I just really would like an intelligent, honest answer for why I'm wrong about Spar. Please.
Yes.
Asking nicely.
And remember, he's the one with the controversial topics. I'm innocent. We'll have
controversial. It's an opinion.
Sure. We'll let them attack you, you know.
It's not like I'm saying Kids Johnson's a horrible person.
I didn't say that, but
I'm
you
sure
just
she's
did,
delightful.
So.
I would like to talk to her about Spar. That'd be interesting.
Well, maybe we could do that for one of our episodes one day. We can do a interviewee thing. We'll talk about that off the air. Off the air? We're not even really on the air. We're recording on a Skype. That's not real airwaves. Anyway, so we're going to come right back after a musical interlude and go musical interlude. I need to enunciate now. I'm an idiot. We'll come right back to that. We're going to actually go into a couple of news segments. And then we'll get... Yeah, we'll just have that. So we'll be right back, everybody.
And we're back for some news.
So first things first, that we have a new director for Neuromancer movie. It's Natale Vincenzo or Vincenzo Natale. Which is it?
Vincenzo Natale.
Vincenzo Natale.
A few times.
I'm sorry. It's Vincenzo Natale. Have you seen any of his movies, Adam?
I've seen Cube, and it's, you know, if you like kind of surreal survivalist horror, it's really good. Which is weird because there's also a show, reality show called Solitary, that's kind of like a reality show version of Cube, and it's really creeping me out.
Oh, yeah, I've heard. Is that the one where they, like, stick them in little things and stuff happens to them? Like, they're in hovels?
Yeah, that's a very great definition of it. Stick them in things and things happen to them. They stick them in 8 foot, like, an 8 foot by 8 foot octagon, and just basically, you know, torture them until they give up. Winner gets $50,000.
And is it pretty brutal stuff? Like, I don't know, I've not seen it, so.
Some of it is like they have to, like, they had to stand on a bed of like wooden rods for as long as they could, which, you know, is all your weight on a rather small area. But a lot of it is just supposed to frustrate them more than hurt them. And it's not like a really, you know, it's not like actual torture. There's no waterboarding this season. But
this season
it's pretty brutal, and you have to have a strong stomach even to watch it, even though nothing really terrible happens, just because it's such a weird thing to see. But back to Vincenzo Natale.
Yeah, he's the director of Cube, Cypher, and the upcoming movie Splice, which has Adrian Brody in it.
And I think, doesn't it also have Jennifer Connelly? Or someone
I don't
who
think
looks
it's
like
Jennifer
her?
Connelly. It's another lady, but I can't remember her name. I didn't write it down. I should have written it down, but it looks really creepy, Splice, anyway.
Oh, yeah, the trailer, you know, the early release trailer for it was... Oof.
Yeah,
that was something else. Oh, the girl's name is Sarah Polly, which kind of sounds like Jennifer Connelly, so...
It's close enough.
It's a win for me.
Anyway, but Neuromancer, so they have a new director switching off from the guy who made Torque. I don't remember his name. It doesn't really matter, because Torque was a stupid movie.
Is that the motorcycle one?
Yeah, it's some sort of motor... Like, it's like motorcycle version of Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
So, and it, I think it had, like, Ice Cube or LL J or some hack rapper or somebody. I don't know. And rumor still has it that Hayden Christensen's actually still signed up for Neuromancer. to play the lead. I'm not sure how I feel about Hayden Christensen playing the lead.
I don't feel very good about it. He doesn't fit my bill of, you know,
of Case. Yeah,
he's of not Case at all. You know, I thought Case. Yeah, it doesn't. In my head, doesn't seem Hayden Christensen-ly.
No, because Hayden Christensen, like, he just doesn't seem dark enough for me. Like, even when he tried to be really dark in the Star Wars movies, he was never dark enough.
He was silly.
Well, in the second one, he was a lot better in the third one.
He still seemed like a little kid throwing a tantrum to me.
Well, I don't know if you could play it as anything but a kid throwing a freaking tantrum. I mean, if you think about it, like, really is kind of a kid throwing a tantrum. The whole ordeal is so. But at least maybe, hopefully, they won't write any creepy sand romance scenes in the Neuromancer film, because I don't think there are any. That and Amidala, or whatever the heck her name is. What is Amidala, right? Queen Amidala?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Padme Amidala. Like, it, you know, Case's semi-love interest is like a super ninja, so he's, you know, she's a little bit more capable of taking him.
Yeah, one with the blades and the fingers.
Yeah, she's kind of a psycho.
That's a great book.
Yeah, it's a classic. Hopefully they'll do a good job of it, but knowing Hollywood, they'll F it up real bad, and then we'll be stuck with a really bad, like, rash.
Well, I think it's probably going to work better now than it would have when it was written, because it's a very visual book, actually. It has a lot of, you know, great long scenes of description. Plus, they'll get the Matrix part of it correct, where he's like in the computer, when he's the VR part of it, right?
Yeah. Well, hopefully they do that well, and they don't take too many pages from the Matrix stuff, just because the similarity. There are too many people who are not smart enough to realize that the book came before the Matrix, and so they might think they're stealing from it.
Yeah, that's a weird one, because the Matrix is such a, you know, blatant ripoff of Neuromancer, and Neuromancer now stands to be a ripoff of the Matrix. So
yeah, even though, you know, Gibson did basically coin the Matrix, so
mm-hmm. And the part that really will be interesting is when they're in space. That's gonna be. See if they get that right, because that
with
was
the
like
Rastas.
Yeah, with the Rastas. I love the Rastas in that book. They're so funny.
I hope they do more than what Gibson did in his book, though. Samuel R. Delaney actually sort of railed against. Not he didn't really rail against him, but he sort of took Gibson to task when people said, you know, that the Rastas are a great representation of African Americans in a science fiction novel, and Delaney was like, not really. You know, and even Gibson sort of acknowledged, like, they weren't very prominent figures, and they weren't sort of very well drawn in terms of being sort of good figures. But they are fantastic characters, and they could do so much with them, so hopefully they will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm cautiously optimistic about that. That guy's also, you see, he's directing a Ballard story.
Oh, which one?
I cannot remember what it's called. It's the one where the story is of a city building right outside of London, and there's like class wars between the levels. What's that called?
Oh, I know what one you're talking about. I have it. I cannot remember the title. We'll put it in the show notes if we can remember what it is by the time we put this up. So, which will be like this weekend, barring disaster. Like a hurricane, since I'm in Florida, you know, it might happen. Are we still in hurricane season? I'm inland. I don't really know what happens on the coast.
Oh. Well, Florida's a peninsula, so how can you have an inland in a peninsula?
Well, I mean, inside the peninsula. I'm, like, inside the giant finger.
Okay.
Yeah, like, you know what I mean. I mean, it's still a couple hours to the ocean, so just give me a break.
I think it's the biggest news article of the week, even though it's relatively minor to most people, which is Asimov's opening to electronic submissions.
Yeah, about freaking time.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
Yeah, and it's gonna be fun because now the other two, the Analog and FNSF, are now going to have to struggle to be just as cool as Azamov's. They totally missed the bandwagon. But you know more about the submission system, because they took the Clark's World system, correct?
Yeah, Neil, or whoever wrote the Clark's World system, Asimov's actually has the newest version of that system, although they don't have the whole place in queue feature, which makes the Clark's World system just that much better than everyone else.
Okay.
It just has a little notification that says received, which is better than a lot of email submissions where they don't give you any confirmation. You just have to, you know, wait 2 months, query, and then like, oh, we never got your submission, and you're, you know, grit your teeth. So it's better than that, and it's a very simple system to use anytime you're uploading through a form versus email. It's just easier and more, you just know that they have it versus an email where things go to a spam filter.
Yeah, that's true. I actually already submitted a piece to them, like, on the day that they announced it.
Me too.
Oh, well, too. Fantastic. Well, good luck to both of us then.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I think that one I may have actually submitted to them last year, accidentally.
I thought you didn't submit anything to the print places.
I generally don't. I think it was last year before I decided I was done. just because it was costing me like $2 to $3 every time I was submitting it, and I was like a poor college student. You know, like, I don't have any money. I can't pay, you know, to send out a story a couple, you know, 5 or 6 times a month. That's like, you know, that's a bit of money that I could spend feeding myself instead, which, you know, it's not that much money, but when you're a poor college student, you know, $10 can make it or break it, so.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about Neil Gaiman now, because Neil Gaiman took $45,000 to talk at a library recently in Stillwater, Minnesota. And it's apparently caused quite a controversy because, for obvious reasons, that's a lot of money to pay for any one person to come talk at a library. Now, during the sort of, you know, the recession and everything, $45,000 does seem like a lot of money to pay, and that represented a third of the entire budget for that program. It's this club book series in which their author appearances are a part. And there are 9 authors for this thing, and they paid $45,000 to Gaiman. And the sad thing is I think it's going to spell bad news for libraries, even though it shouldn't. But the fact is a lot of people are really miffed about this, not knowing the full circumstances. In fact, we didn't know about it until only like 2 hours ago, I think. We both didn't know. You knew before I did, but yeah.
Well, of course I did.
Yeah, well, you had the up and up, and I was lost in the abyss of the internet, so.
Well, yeah, it's kind of, you know, hard to, you know, to find it, actually, because Gaiman's post is titled Political Football in a Teacup, which doesn't make any sense, you know, because the other articles are like, Gaiman talk doesn't come cheap, and so you're like trying to find the rebuttal, but it's hard to find it. But yeah, he laid out a lot of really good points. I think, like, if you just step away from the actual amount, his reason for charging, you know, an exorbitant amount in the first place is so people won't book him at, for more events than he can handle, so he can, you know, write more, which is, you know, it's like when Scalzi, you know, jokingly said he'd, you know, if someone gave him $5,000, he'd write them a short story, and someone actually did. it's kind of like that, and he also, of course, you know, if just for this specific circumstance, we both agree that it makes it better because he donated all the money to charity.
Yeah, that's right. He donated, was it like 25% of it went to some sort of social. Social workers or something like that, and the rest of it went to a library book deal thingy.
Yeah, and then he kind of brags about how much money he makes for like half the post, and
to be fair, I mean, he's got all these movie deals the last 10 years, all these stuff that they've turned into movies of his. His books are on the bestseller list like all the time. Instructions is on the, it's like number 4, like started at number 4. It's like ridiculous. So I mean, he like, does make a lot of money off of his books.
Yeah, I don't know why. I read American Gods straight through, and it was like 300 pages too long.
I haven't read American Gods yet. Stardust I read, which I really enjoyed. I love the movie, too. But I read the book Stardust, and Stardust is quite good. He's really good with the fairy tale stuff. The way he sort of twists fairy tales is really fantastic, and Stardust is like a great example of that. He's really good with Stardust. You should read Stardust.
Yeah, it'll go on my list.
Good, good. That's one of my favorites. It's kind of quirky, and it's fun. It's a lot
okay,
of fun.
I'll put towards the middle of the list, like 200, 300. No, it looked really campy, like, to use that word again.
It is, but it's campy in a good way. It's intentionally campy because it's literally riffing off of all these sort of like fairy tale story kind of stuff. Like everything that happens, it is like derivative of some sort of fairy tale or myths and things like that. And so the whole thing is kind of campy on purpose because that's the world that these people live in. It's this weird world of fairy tales and magic. And it's literally like going into a fairy tale, but like somebody threw in some dark sauce and like, yeah.
Dark sauce.
Dark sauce. We're going to call it dark sauce now.
That is Neil Gaiman's secret, dark sauce. Find the recipe at foodnetwork.com.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm not sure what's in it. I'm sure there's soy sauce in it.
Probably a lot. Mostly soy sauce.
Mostly soy sauce. Well, this is good. Now we know.
Which, fun fact, is what Neil Gaiman writes his books with. So.
With soy sauce, really?
No.
No? Oh, you just made that up.
Yeah, it was a poor attempt at humor.
Oh, well, I mean, that would be interesting. Yeah, soy sauce, fountain pen. You could write with soy sauce. That'd be interesting.
Well, it'd bleed into the paper pretty hardcore.
You'd get really thick paper.
Or really thick soy sauce.
There you go. Problem solved. It'd be like the Harry Potter book from the movie.
Oh, yeah, the Diary of Tom Riddle.
Yes, yes.
That was a silly
book. Tom Riddle. Lord Voldemort. Anyway, moving on. And I'm going to let you introduce the final bit of wonderful book and author news.
Oh, yeah, this is something near and dear to my heart. Tyra Banks sold a 3-book fantasy trilogy to Delacorte called, what is it called, Model Land?
Yeah, yeah. She just crammed the two words together. Yeah.
Yep, and it's supposed to be, you know, America's Next Top Model meets Harry Potter, which will be interesting to say the least. There's an academy called Intoxibel Loss, I think we decided it's pronounced.
Yeah.
Where the most exceptional models known to humankind go to do their model thing, and they also harbor unknown powers. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we agreed we're going to read it when it comes out.
Because,
yes. It's on my most anticipated list, along with, you know, the new China Mieville. I put it right under Kraken, you know? That's where... and right above the Paul McCauley re-release of Cowboy Angels. That's where Model Land goes.
Yeah, right up there. Oh, it's real high up on your list, man. I don't think I can justify that even for a joke. I mean, it's ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. But, you know, she'll sell lots of books, and I'm sure lots of people will love it just because it's Tyra Banks.
I'm serious, you know. I read Twilight. I'm going to read this.
Fine, we'll read this together. We'll do this for a show. We will do like a... Whenever it comes, it'll probably come out like months from now when we'll disappear. We'll like disappear from the internet. But we'll definitely do it. If we're still around, we'll definitely do that. We'll read it. And
oh, we'll be around. It comes out summer 2011. Oh, summer 2011.
Oh, wow. That's a while from now. Yeah.
So well, maybe they're serious. Maybe Tyra Banks is actually going to write a trilogy.
Well, I mean, I don't know if she's going to do the writing. I think I mentioned this off air, but she's not actually going to do the writing. I'm going to ghostwrite this.
I mean, she might. She might.
Maybe she has the talent. Like, maybe this is something that Tyra Banks has that nobody knows about, you know? Like, it's a secret talent. Like, you know, nobody knew J.K. Rowling could write Harry Potter. You know, she was just a single mom lady, and now she's, like, the most famous woman in the world, so...
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
I don't
most
know.
Famous woman, most famous writer that's a woman in the world, so...
Yeah, okay, so if it comes out summer 2011, and they go at, like, a six-month interview, that means the last book will come out right before the world ends December 2012 around, so... Maybe this is, like, a harbinger to the world ending, as Tyra Banks will win a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, good lord. And, oh no, because Sarah Palin's coming out with another book soon, too. This is all leading up to the end. The Mayans were right.
Yes. Yes, they were.
So we're back after that musical interlude of, like, 30 seconds. And now we're going to talk about Diana Gabaldon, her fan fiction...
Drunken Rant, I think
yes.
We went with.
Yes,
drunken Rage.
Rant. Drunken Rage. It was a Drunken Rage. There we
it
go.
It was. It was
yes.
Pretty ragey. Wow.
It was really brutal. The stuff she said on her thing. There were three particularly prominent points she made, which was, I thought were priceless. The first one that she thinks fan fiction's immoral, for one. Not just illegal. She knows it's illegal, but she made the point that it's immoral. Which goes along with her second point, which is that she likens fan fiction to trying to seduce her husband. Which...
Sorry.
No, you're... No. I think somewhere along the line, somebody tried to make the indication that she was... calling fan fiction people rapists or like raping her of her fiction. I don't think she actually said that. I think that may have been a commentator, but since the posts are no longer up, she deleted them all. I had to suck them up from her RSS feed. Yeah, she's kind of cowardly. She removed them all. But I didn't get to go through all the comments. But yeah, she makes some really bad comparisons. It's very clear, like, she hates fan fiction. It makes her really upset. And I guess I could understand, like, if you care that much about characters. But and then the third point she makes is that she thinks all fan fiction should be repressed on aesthetic grounds. The argument being that the vast majority of it's just bad crap, and particularly pornographic, and so you should just suppress it. Which hits a nerve for me, because I hate censorship, like, with a passion that drives me nuts. In terms of, like, literature, like, you know, like, censorship in certain areas, I can understand. Like, you can't, like, let some guy just walk into your store and, like, you know, start screaming obscenities at children in a toy store. Like, that's just not cool. But, you know, like, if somebody wants to write something just because you don't like it doesn't mean you can repress it.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
So,
it's, you know, censorship in art, we both agree, is wrong. You have the choice whether to... you know, create it or to view it.
Exactly.
It's, you know, a moot point. But, yeah, well, it's just, you know, a lot of people who write fan fiction are just, they're huge fans of the series. And a lot of it, you know, they write it because they can't wait or there's a thing they like that the writer hasn't done. And so, and most people who are big fans of it probably can imitate the style, so I don't know. I bet a lot of it is bad writing, but probably not all of it.
I think the consensus is that the vast majority of fan fiction is pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm sure there are diamonds in the rough. Some of the stuff that came up, at least from George R. R. Martin when he talked about this, were things like the Marianne Zimmer Bradley. For a while, she had this series of books called the Darkover books, and those were... basically books made up of fan fiction. She actually encouraged people to write fan fiction and submit, and if my understanding is correct, they were paid for the stuff. It basically was like a shared world deal. But
yeah.
At the time, it was like fan fiction-ish. And for her, she was okay with it, and then there was some altercation with a fan. And the information about it's kind of difficult because there's Bradley's version and the fan's version. Bradley's version and the fan version are so drastically different. And really, I don't know either of them on a personal level, so I don't know who to believe. But basically, something happened in which someone wanted to use somebody's stuff, and somebody sued somebody, and so Bradley said that's enough, and she shut down the whole operation, and there were no more Dark Over books. Because literally, like, it just, I'm guessing it just ruined the whole thing for her. But I don't know the full deal. Martin has a particular version of it. Wikipedia has a different version of it. The fan has an even different version of it. And Bradley has another version of it. So I'm not sure we'll have the full stuff unless somebody releases the legal documents. But now we're digressing.
Was there, like, any indication of what sparked the drunken rage?
I don't know if there was a specific event. I think maybe she got linked to something that she found particularly offensive, which probably was, like, Outlander porn. And then she just, like, flipped.
Well, if that is, then she's probably, you know, one of those, you know, type of writers who thinks that, you know, their characters are their actual children, and
she does, yeah.
In the end, it's just their words. All that person's doing is using words that, you know, Gabaldon used in a different way. So now it doesn't bug me. If someone wrote fan fiction porn or something I wrote, I'd probably find it amusing. You know, I wouldn't rage against it. I'd just be like, oh, that's interesting. I'm not authorizing that, but I think George R. R. Martin, you know, he had the little vein of it's about consent.
Yeah.
And you know, that's true. If a writer does want, you know, if a writer doesn't mind it, then go by all means write fan fiction. But if a writer has come out and said, hopefully politely, Miss Gabaldon, that she doesn't like fan fiction or he doesn't like fan fiction, then I think, you know, the reader should respect that.
Well, I think, like, with Martin's point, I think it needs to be taken even further, because I have a problem. I don't think that any author should have to tell people not to do it. I think people should have to ask. Because this is the problem I also have with the Google Books settlement, in which authors have to go to Google to opt out. And that, to me, seems very wrong. It should not be that way. Google should have to go to the authors to either ask them for it, or authors have to opt in. You can't have it, like, with fan fiction, you can't have, like, well, we're going to do it because you didn't say anything, and then all of a sudden, when somebody says something, like, you have a problem with it. Like, no, I mean, you literally, I think all people who want to write fan fiction should go to the person and say, look, I want to write fanfic. Is that okay if I do that on, like, fanfiction.com or net or whatever it is? You know, and if they don't get permission, then they don't do it.
Well, you know, they can write it. They just can't, you know, put it into a public domain of any sort.
Right. I mean, you can do basically whatever you want in your own free space, but...
Because you can't, yeah, you can't control that at all.
Yeah. The only good thing that did come out of this is that even though she started with this sort of drunken rage where she says some, like, pretty horrible stuff about
rude.
Fan fiction. Yeah, I mean, it's immoral. You're eating babies and... I don't know, whatever god-awful stuff immoral. I don't even know what immoral means. Like, what is immoral to who? But anyway, digressing. But there was a good thing that did come out of this, and that is she did sort of change her tune later on, and she did release a statement in which she doesn't want fan fiction, and it's not rude. But part of what was going on with this was that somebody was trying to sell a fan fiction piece in order to auction it off for money to help pay for breast cancer treatment. Which is kind of rough, and even though it's illegal, she can't do it. There was, like, it wasn't sure whether Gabaldon was going to, like, be okay with it. And then Gabaldon actually was very kind and donated autographed copies of her books for the auction, which I thought was really, really cool of Gabaldon. Like, if you were going to make a turnaround at the end of all this, that is a great way to do it.
Well, it's a great bit of, you know, publicity.
Well, it's good for Gabaldon.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it's good for Gabald,
Because, you know,
but
there are so many people who are mad at her, and she is, like, trying to, you know, save profit margins now by donating autographed copies of her books, which they don't cost her anything, you know? That's
yeah.
like donating grass from your yard to a sod auction.
But I don't think it's fair to say that, because
Right,
I
of
really
course.
don't think that after this big stink that Gabaldon would have seen any significant drop in sales. I
Well,
think
no,
she's
she's a big enough author not to.
Yeah. So,
But
I mean, there's really no reason for her to do this. There's no reason for her to save face. She's not really going to lose anything out of this, really. Her fans are still rabid fans. Not that many people are going to not buy her books. I do think, I mean, maybe you're some aspect you're right, that this is a publicity deal, but I do think it's a nice thing to do.
Oh, I know I am right, and it doesn't matter what type of gesture it is. It doesn't matter how it ends. It's still, I'm pretty sure, you know, I'm not trying to be rude against Gabaldon. I've never read her books. I don't know her. This is just what an outside observer is see like me is seeing when I look at it, and that seems like she's trying to save face.
Well, maybe she is. Maybe she is. Maybe she had a real change of heart and her mind sort of really changed after talking with people. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm not inside her head. But then again, it wouldn't be the first time that somebody tried to save face after doing something really, really messed up. I mean, really, one thing to say immoral, it's another thing to say that fan fiction is like trying to seduce her husband.
I was really trying hard not to laugh during that. It's just so absurd. If she is honestly that devoted to her books, then she shouldn't be married. You know, 'cause then
Yeah.
she is having an affair every time she sits down at the keyboard.
Yeah, that's true. She is probably having an affair with her characters. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Like, I mean, personally, I don't have a problem with fan fiction. I mean, people do it for whatever reason. I don't read the stuff. I never will. I have no intention. I really don't want to write fan fiction. I have enough problems with media tie-in novels, which is something I'm trying to work out of, but
I some of them I also I'm trying to, because I don't know, I haven't ever read a decent media tie-in novel, haven't read many, and certainly haven't read a good one.
I
Well, no,
have.
actually I did. I when I was little, there I got from one of those Scholastic book orders a Lost in Space series, and it was awesome. It was so media tie-in novels actually was one of the things that got me into science fiction,
Well,
along
that's the
with
way it
better
worked with
books
me
like
too.
Dune, so.
I started with Star Wars books, and with the Dragonlance stuff got me into fantasy, which is technically a meaty tie-in, because it's, I think, isn't it based off of some D&D thing or whatever? I don't know enough about it, but I did get into sci-fi from Star Wars, and I did read quite a few good Star Wars novels, and then I just stopped reading them, and I have never gone back to media tie-in for a long time, so I don't know. Maybe I'll go back one day. I just got signed copies of Tobias Bekkell's Halo books, so maybe I'll.
Yeah, well, you know, Halo, what, that's Ringworld.
It's Ringworld?
I mean, well, it is. Halo is, it uses, it's like a low scientific version of Ringworld with a little Forever War thrown in. I mean, for a video game, sure, it's decent. If you know science fiction at all, it's so derivative.
Oh, well, I don't think it's a decent video game. I find it annoying, but
Well, it's a, I it was fun when I played it 7 years ago, or eight, however long ago it was. I don't know. I'm not, ever since I started writing, I haven't played video games really.
yeah, I kind of stopped playing video games too, so. Yeah, so I mean, that's basically all that's really happened with fan fiction. There's a lot of other stuff, like, we'll link to the George R. R. Martin's posts. I'd love to link to the Gabaldon again, but I literally had to filch the text from her RSS feed, which I now have saved on my computer, so she can never get rid of it. It'll always be there. And I'd love to give it out, but I actually think I don't want to get sued, and I think I could get sued if I distributed that.
I don't know, 'cause she put it in the public, you know, domain.
She did, but I'm. But she also then tried to remove it, and then I would be distributing her words. I don't know. It's a gray area. It's something I'd have to look into. But I mean, really, if anybody who's listening to this wants to read it, all they have to do is subscribe to our RSS feed and scroll down until they find it. The three posts are still there. You can't get the comments anymore. I don't know how to get the comments. I'm sure Google cached it somewhere, but yeah. But I mean, basically, it's out there. Talk a little bit about what we're reading, what we're writing, and then we're gonna say goodnight, leave you guys with a question to answer. So, Adam, what are you reading right now?
Right now, Pyre so graciously sent me Paul McCauley's sequel to The Quiet War, Gardens of the Sun.
The one with the sexy cover.
It has a very sexy cover. It's green, you know, really good. Classic style science fiction art, but with a digital edge. But that's not why I'm reading the book. I'm reading the book because The Quiet War was an amazing, you know, solar system based space opera that had a lot of, you know, what some people are calling the green punk movement in it.
Oh, but cool.
Yeah, but it was written before that. It was cool because he took the green movement to kind of a J.G. Ballard-esque level where there are green saints who are these master biologists who have created organisms that are helping repair Earth after global warming has run amok. But you know, and then there are these and it's basically Earth, which is kind of a more feudal system of government now versus the outer solar system, like the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, where transhumanism is trying to take humanity in a bunch of different directions. And it's about this war between them, and it's good because McCauley doesn't take a side on who is right in this war. It's a very balanced book. It's not preachy at all. And his science is so spot on and well worked into the story, because there are a lot of science fiction authors where, you know, the info dump is king. And it's just, you know, accessible, and it's very stimulating read if you are a fan of science fiction, especially a space opera.
Somebody definitely has a man crush on McCauley.
Well, you don't get many, you know, new science fiction writers who can, you know, who can write like that, who write, you know, classic adventure science fiction with a modern edge.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, I'm currently reading, like, 15 bazillion things as I'm presenting an essay in July. I'm actually reading Angel Dust Apocalypse by the author whose name I have forgotten. I will probably burn myself for that later. I'll put a link in the thing, we'll put a link in the notes for that. I'm reading that for this essay I'm working on, and then I started The Left Hand of God by, I forget the first name, but the last name's Hoffman, which Penguin just sent me today.
Paul, you got that? I wanted to read that. It sounded really cool.
So far it's pretty good. I'm only like 10 pages into it. So far it's pretty good. The cover is gorgeous. It's not like what you see typically of fantasy, with like the whole front cover is like a bunch of hooded figures with swords. Like, there is a hooded figure, but it doesn't take up the whole front cover. And like the back cover has this really pretty sort of like, almost looks like a matte painting of some sort of medieval setting. It's really nice.
Is that did you get the American version of that or the British one? Because the British one, I thought, had a cooler cover.
Oh, I have no idea what the British one looks like.
Purple.
Oh, no, this one's not purple. It's American.
Yeah, I saw. That kind of looks like, I've seen that cover before. Not the exact one, but...
Fine. It's not as good as the hoity-toity British one.
Hey, British covers are almost always better. I mean, the Mad Hatter at Bookshinary.blogspot.com does all kinds of cover showdowns, and British ones win all the time. We'll put both links to the covers in the show notes.
Yeah.
And then our raving fans can tell us which one's better.
Yes, our raving fans that are currently zero at the recording of this podcast, because nobody actually has listened to it yet. Although maybe there'll be fans before they get to this point, and then we'll have actual fans at this point.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
So There may be like one. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, enough of that. So that's what I'm reading, and I'm reading a bunch of other stuff that I've tried. Servant to a Dark God by John Brown. I've kind of stopped reading that. And then reading Blake Charlton's Spellwright, which I'm like 70 pages into that. But I just couldn't pass up trying this book because it just, the way they sent me like this cool colored map that came with it, like in the publishing materials, you know?
Oh, lucky.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'm so mad they folded it though to fit in the damn package because I'm putting that stuff on my wall because I love fantasy maps. I got like a total hard on for those kind of things, so it's going on my wall. I actually have a fantasy map, a map that I had commissioned for one of my worlds, and I have it on my wall above my bed. So
you commissioned a map for
by hand, and I had a guy actually do it in color with the
And you complain about being a poor college student.
Yeah, I wasn't a poor college student then.
Well, I'm also reading, I read, you know, a ton of short fiction, as anyone who knows, you know, comes to my blog knows, because, you know, short fiction is the highest form of the literary arts. So I just got, you know, secondhand copies of Dangerous Visions, and again, Dangerous Visions, which were the, you know, probably the most influential anthologies of the 20th century in terms of science fiction, edited by Harlan Ellison. I have those sitting waiting for me to just dive in as soon as finals week is over. I cannot wait. I mean, he commissioned every story. Every story is an original that was first published there, and they were all, you know, they were, you know, he wanted them to write stories that they thought might not be published elsewhere, you know, just whatever controversy, you know. J.G. Ballard's The Assassination of John and Fitzgerald Kennedy as a Downhill Car Race was supposed to be in Dangerous Visions, but J.G. Ballard's agent was like, this is too, you know, too raw. This, you can't do this yet. So he nixed it, and he didn't tell anyone. So J.G. Ballard wrote a, you know, hate note to Harlan Ellison. Ellison, you know, wrote an Ellison-esque note back. But it's going to be fun. It is going to be a ton of fun to go through those two, you know, doorstops.
Well, that's great. Well, we got to wrap this up pretty quick, so just fairly quickly, what are we writing? Well, I'm working on a flash fiction piece of bizarro fiction, which is like a first for me because I really don't write bizarro, but in which people have their like loved ones immediately after they die, they take the good bits and make household pets out of them, which is kind of creepy. That's mostly what I'm writing. I'm working on a bunch of other stuff, but that's the one piece I'm working on right now. What about you, Adam?
Well, the story I'm working on and have been working on for a while is a new weird type piece about people actually birthing ideas, you know, anthropomorphic ideas from their skull. They come out looking like little corn husk dolls, and you feed other bits of hacked up ideas to them to
That's so
make
awesome.
Them grow. And when they get to a size that you think, you know, is novel length or novella length, you boil them and eat them and go into a trance where you write your novel. And
that is
so
awesome.
Yeah, I have people give me weird looks when I tell them that one, because it's kind of like you're raising a child and eating it. And it's weird, it's new weird, it's twisted. It is a ton of fun to write. I cannot wait till it's over, though, because it has been a marathon of a story.
Yeah, I know how that does. That goes, man. Yeah, I'm not currently buried that much into a story yet, but give me some time. I'll get buried pretty soon. All right, so that's basically our show. So we're going to leave you guys with a question. If you guys want to contact us with your answers, you can send an email to skiffyandfanti@gmail.com. That's Skiffy with a K, not with a C.
And two Fs.
Yes, and two Fs. skiffyandfanti@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on this post, depending where you're getting this from. Or you can blog about it and send us a link. But our question is, following on the Lachlan post, you know, what has your experience been like within the genre community, whether that be fantasy, science fiction, romance, mystery, whatever, as long as it's genre fiction and you're part of that community, what has it been like, good or bad? Tell us. And yeah.
And our blog, we should mention, is skiffyandfanti.wordpress.com.
Yeah, it's at WordPress right now.
It's at WordPress right now. Leave it. We'll post our show notes, our links there. Leave a comment if it's interesting. we might read it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we'll definitely, we can do like a mail segment. That'd be great.
If it's controversial or funny, we'll definitely read it. So
yes,
try to make
it
interesting.
Welcome.
You know, we need some more humor. We're kind of dry this first episode. We promise it'll get funnier. If I can promise that.
Yes, I'll get more insane when I get more comfortable. Trust me.
It, honestly, if all else fails, we'll read the little jokes that come on the back of Laffy Taffy. Those are hilarious.
Alrighty, well, this is our first episode of the Skiffy and Fanty Show, so stay tuned for the second episode, which will, barring disaster, come up next week. Same time, same place. Alright, see you guys later.
Good night.
Autobots, roll out!